Welcome to Learning English from the Voice of America. I'm Katie Weaver. On the show today, Brian Lynn and I tell about a huge new museum in Washington, D.C. We also hear an excerpt of another What It Takes podcast from the American Academy of Achievement. And as always, we close the show with an American story. But first, here is Susan Shand.
Vietnam's largest technology company may profit from a free trade deal agreed to at the Asia-Pacific Economic Cooperation, or APEC, meetings in Da Nang this month. The new agreement replaces the Trans-Pacific Partnership, from which the United States withdrew in January. 11 countries meeting at APEC agreed to the new deal. On the basis of the results of 4 rounds of negotiations, ministers have agreed on some important contents, including an agreement of a new name for TPP with 11 members, the Comprehensive Progressive Agreement for Trans-Pacific Partnership, CPTPP, said Chun Thuan Ong, Vietnam's trade minister, on Saturday. The redesigned deal came after President Donald Trump took the United States, the world's largest market, out of the TPP. Trump said he preferred bilateral agreements to large treaties. Chung Za Bain, chairman of Vietnam's largest technology company, FPT, spoke to VOA about protectionism as a barrier to free trade. He said he believes the U.S. will return to trade talks. I strongly believe at a certain point the U.S. will come back to discuss strong commitment to growth. And I think that's going to be the way America goes as the leader in the world, Bain said. Vietnam hopes to be one of the biggest beneficiaries of free trade as it expands in the Pacific. Vietnam has rapidly growing exports, including technology. FPT is growing its operations at home. It opened a large new building in Da Nang in April. Speaking at the new building, Bain discussed his belief in free trade. I think that's very important for Vietnam, not only open to the world, but also to improve the regulations for trading and manufacturing and make Vietnam more international, he said. Technology is growing fast in Vietnam. For domestic, we normally got 15% annually. For export, we normally get 25% per year, said Bain. Intel and Samsung are among the biggest investors in the country, he added. In 2010, Intel opened a $1 billion chip factory in Vietnam. Samsung makes half of its mobile phones in the country. By some estimates, they account for 20% of Vietnam's exports. Free trade and investment are driving Vietnam's economy. It has one of the strongest growth rates in Asia, at more than 6% a year. Vietnam has trade deals with a number of other countries, including South Korea and Japan. Bain said his company's largest operation is in Japan. He said the country is a big market, where the company sees continued growth. A Trans-Pacific deal, even without the United States, would also help the economy, since Vietnam would trade more with its neighbors. FPT says it will not miss the worldwide digital revolution. Vietnam was late for the last three industrial revolutions, said Bain. He said this may be the last chance for the country to catch up with the rest of the world. I'm Susan Shand.
Washington, D.C. is a city full of museums. Visitors have a large choice of places to go to learn about United States history, culture, and art. The latest one to open in Washington is the Museum of the Bible. The 40,000 square meter building is located near the U.S. Capitol, the National Mall, and several Smithsonian museums. Unlike most major museums in Washington, the $500 million Museum of the Bible was not financed by the government. An American businessman, Steve Green, mostly paid for it. He is the president of Hobby Lobby, a large business that sells arts and crafts. Green's idea for the museum came after he privately collected more than 300 Bible-related artifacts. He wanted a way to share these items with the rest of the world in a permanent home. Green says the goal of the museum is to educate people, not preach to them. There's just a basic need for people to read the book, he told reporters. We just want to present the facts and let visitors decide.
Museum officials have said the institution is not intended to represent the views of any particular religious or political group. They noted that more than 100 scholars representing a variety of groups helped design all exhibits in the museum. However, some religious scholars have questioned whether the museum provides a balanced view of the Bible and religious history. Joel Bodden is a professor at Yale Divinity School and co-author of the book Bible Nation. He told Reuters the museum leaves out some important history relating to other major world religions. They are telling a story of the Bible that is a particularly American Protestant one. He said little attention was given to Roman Catholics, Jews, Muslims, and Mormons.
There are also concerns about the museum's true intentions because of several controversies involving Steve Green and Hobby Lobby. Green and his family have been very public in opposing birth control and supporting efforts to include Bible teachings in U.S. public schools. In 2014, Hobby Lobby won a U.S. Supreme Court case giving the right to deny workers at family-owned companies health coverage for birth control. In July, Hobby Lobby also was ordered to pay a $3 million fine and return artifacts the company bought without knowing the items had been smuggled out of Iraq. The company admitted it should have taken greater care in doing business with its dealers. Museum officials said none of those items were meant to be put in the Museum of the Bible. John Fay is head of the history department at Messiah College, a private Christian college in the state of Pennsylvania. He said he thinks it will be very difficult for the museum to remain neutral in providing information about the Holy Book. It's going to be very, very hard to present the Bible in that way, he said, because the Bible is always so sort of ensconced and so connected to a particular religious tradition and their way of interpreting it.
Visitors enter the museum through a dramatic 12-meter-tall bronze entrance containing writing from the first book of the Bible, Genesis. One museum official said about the design, "When you walk in, you're really walking into the Bible." The writing on the doors came from an early version of the Gutenberg Bible. The Gutenberg Bible was the first major book printed in Europe with movable type. Among the many Bibles shown at the museum is one called the Elliott Indian Bible. The museum says it was the first Bible printed in America in a Native American language. The museum collection also includes several first editions of the King James Bible and early versions from Christian Reformation leader Martin Luther.
Also shown are a large collection from the Dead Sea Scrolls and what the museum describes as the world's largest collection of Torah scrolls, covering more than 700 years of history. In addition, visitors can explore an area on the Bible's influence on cultures around the world, including education, literature, and art. Included in this area are a Bible once owned by Elvis Presley and modern fashion designs inspired by biblical subjects. There is no cost to visit the museum, but donations are accepted.
Now it is time for What It Takes. Former civil rights leader Coretta Scott King is the subject. To hear the whole podcast, go to our website, learningenglish.voanews.com.
I know something about what it is like to be a young person struggling to succeed against adversity. As an African-American child growing up in the segregated South, I was told one way or another almost every day of my life that I wasn't as good as a white child. When I went to the movies with other black children, we had to sit in the balcony while the white kids got to sit in the better seats below. We had to walk to school while the white children rode in school buses paid for by our parents' taxes. Such messages saying we were inferior were a daily part of our lives. But I was blessed with parents who taught me not to let anyone make me feel like it wasn't good enough. And as my mother told me, you are just as good as anyone else. You get an education and try to be somebody. Then you won't have to be kicked around by anybody. And you won't have to depend on anyone for your livelihood. Not even a man.
Coretta Scott King was speaking here to an Academy of Achievement gathering in 1999. It was at the National Cathedral in Washington, D.C. She stood at the pulpit, that same pulpit where her husband, Martin Luther King Jr., stood 31 years before to deliver what would be the last Sunday sermon of his life. Coretta told her audience on that day she spoke that she was often asked how she managed to be so involved in the civil rights struggle while raising four children.
I can only reply that when God calls you to a great task, He provides you with the strength to accomplish what He has called you to do. Faith and prayer, family and friends were always available when I needed them. And of course, Martin and I always were there for each other. I learned that when you are willing to make sacrifices for a great cause, you will never be alone because you will have divine companionship and the support of good people. This same faith and cosmic companionship sustained me after my husband was assassinated and gave me the strength to make my contribution to carrying forward his unfinished work.
Next up, an American story. Here is Shep O'Neill with The Ransom of Red Chief by O. Henry.
It looked like a good thing. But wait till I tell you. We were down south in Alabama, Bill Driscoll and myself, when this kidnapping idea struck us. There was a town down there as flat as a pancake and called Summit. Bill and I had about $600. We needed just $2,000 more for an illegal land deal in Illinois. We chose for our victim the only child of an influential citizen named Ebenezer Dorset. He was a boy of 10, with red hair. Bill and I thought that Ebenezer would pay a ransom of $2,000 to get his boy back, but wait till I tell you. About 2 miles from Summit was a little mountain covered with cedar trees. There was an opening on the back of the mountain. We stored our supplies in that cave. One night, we drove a horse and carriage past old Dorset's house. The boy was in the street throwing rocks at a cat on the opposite fence. "Hey, little boy," says Bill, "would you like to have a bag of candy and a nice ride?" The boy hits Bill directly in the eye with a piece of rock. That boy put up a fight like a wild animal, but at last we got him down in the bottom of the carriage and drove away. We took him up to the cave. The boy had 2 large bird feathers stuck in his hair. He points a stick at me and says, "Ha, paleface, do you dare to enter the camp of Red Chief, the terror of the plains?"
"He's all right now," says Bill, rolling up his pants and examining wounds on his legs. "We're playing Indian. I'm old Hank, the trapper, Red Chief's captive. I'm going to be scalped at daybreak by Geronimo. That kid can kick hard." "Red Chief," says I to the boy, "would you like to go home?"
"Ah, what for?" says he. "I don't have any fun at home. I hate to go to school. I like to camp out. You won't take me back home again, will you?"
"Not right away," says I. "We'll stay here in the cave for a while."
"All right," says he. "That'll be fine. I never had such fun in all my life."
We went to bed about 11 o'clock. Just at daybreak, I was awakened by a series of terrible screams from Bill,
Red Chief was sitting on Bill's chest with one hand holding his hair. In the other, he had a sharp knife. He was attempting to cut off the top of Bill's head based on what he had declared the night before. I got the knife away from the boy, but after that event, Bill's spirit was broken. He lay down, but he never closed an eye again in sleep as long as that boy was with us.
"Do you think anybody will pay out money to get a little imp like that back home?" Bill asked.
"Sure," I said. "A boy like that is just the kind that parents love. Now, you and the chief get up and make something to eat while I go up on the top of this mountain and look around." I climbed to the top of the mountain. Over toward summit, I expected to see the men of the village searching the countryside, but all was peaceful. "Perhaps," says I to myself, "it has not yet been discovered that the wolves have taken the lamb from the fold." I went back down the mountain. When I got to the cave, I found Bill backed up against the side of it. He was breathing hard, with the boy threatening to strike him with a rock.
"He put a red-hot potato down my back," explained Bill, "and then crushed it with his foot. I hit his ears. Have you got a gun with you, Sam?"
I took the rock away from the boy and ended the argument.
"I'll fix you," says the boy to Bill. "No man ever yet struck the Red Chief but what he got paid for it. You better be careful."
After eating, the boy takes a leather object with strings tied around it from his clothes and goes outside the cave, unwinding it. Then we heard a kind of shout. It was Red Chief holding a sling in one hand. He moved it faster and faster around his head. Just then I heard a heavy sound and a deep breath from Bill. A rock, the size of an egg, had hit him just behind his left ear. Bill fell in the fire across the frying pan of hot water for washing the dishes. I pulled him out and poured cold water on his head for half an hour. Then I went out and caught that boy and shook him. "If your behavior doesn't improve," says I, "I'll take you straight home. Now, are you going to be good or not?"
"I was only funnin'," says he. "I didn't mean to hurt old Hank, but what did he hit me for? I'll behave if you don't send me home."
I thought it best to send a letter to old man Dorset that day, demanding the ransom and telling how it should be paid. The letter said, "We have your boy hidden in a place far from Summit. We demand $1,500 for his return. The money to be left at midnight tonight at the same place and in the same box as your answer. If you agree to these terms, send the answer in writing by a messenger tonight at 8:30. After crossing Owl Creek, on the road to Poplar Cove, there are 3 large trees. At the bottom of the fence, opposite the 3rd tree, will be a small box. The messenger will place the answer in this box and return immediately to Summit. If you fail to agree to our demand, you will never see your boy again. If you pay the money as demanded,
he will be returned to you safe and well within 3 hours.
I took the letter and walked over to Poplar Cove. I then sat around the post office and store. An old man there says he hears Summit is all worried because of Ebenezer Dorset's boy having been lost or stolen. That was all I wanted to know. I mailed my letter and left. The postmaster said the mail carrier would come by in an hour to take the mail on to Summit. At 8:30, I was up in the third tree, waiting for the messenger to arrive. Exactly on time, a half-grown boy rides up the road on a bicycle. He finds the box at the foot of the fence. He puts a folded piece of paper into it and leaves, turning back toward Summit. I slid down the tree, got the note, and was back at the cave in a half hour. I opened the note and read it to Bill. This is what it said. Gentlemen, I received your letter about the ransom you ask for the return of my son. I think you're a little high in your demands. I hereby make you a counterproposal, which I believe you will accept. You bring Johnny home and pay me $250, and I agree to take him off your hands. You had better come at night, because the neighbors believe he is lost, and I could not be responsible for what they would do to anybody they saw bringing him back. Very respectfully, Ebenezer Dorset.
Great pirates of Penzance, says I, of all the nerve.
But I looked at Bill and stopped. He had the most appealing look in his eyes I ever saw on the face of a dumb or talking animal. Sam, says he, what's $250 after all? We've got the money. One more night of this boy will drive me crazy. I think Mr. Dorset is making us a good offer. You aren't going to let the chance go, are you?
Tell you the truth, Bill, says I. This little lamb has got on my nerves, too. We'll take him home, pay the ransom, and make our getaway.
We took him home that night. We got him to go by telling him that his father had bought him a gun and we were going to hunt bears the next day. It was 12 o'clock when we knocked on Ebenezer's front door. Bill counted out $250 into Dorset's hand. When the boy learned we were planning to leave him at home, he started to cry loudly and held himself as tight as he could to Bill's leg. His father pulled him away, slowly.
How long can you hold him? Asked Bill.
I'm not as strong as I used to be, says old Dorset.
But I think I can promise you 10 minutes.
Enough, says Bill. In 10 minutes, I shall cross the central, southern, and middle western states and be running for the Canadian border.
And as dark as it was, and as fat as Bill was, and as good a runner as I am, he was a good mile and a half out of Summit before I could catch up with him.
That's all the time we have for today's show. For VOA Learning English, I'm Katie Weaver.